Hi, it's Karen Webster for payments.com, and I'm here today with Sarah Davies, Senior Vice President of Analytics, Product Management, and Research for VantageScore. Sarah, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me. Looking forward to it.
So let's give everyone listening a little bit of context. So VantageScore has developed a new scoring model that is optimized for what you describe as the post-recessionary consumer. So before we get into some of the specifics that I know you're interested in talking about, let me first ask you, what's different about that post-recessionary consumer, and why don't existing credit scoring models work?
Let me actually tackle that last phrase, why don't existing credit scoring models work? The reality is that all of these models are working. A credit scoring model rank ordered, simply put, people who have higher likelihood to pay their debts at the top of the credit scoring range, so scores of 750 and above, and people who have lower likelihood of paying their debts at the bottom of the range, that's called rank ordering. So almost all of the credit scores that are available in the industry today are rank ordering. The question then becomes how well they rank order. A perfect credit scoring model will put all of the people who pay a score of 850, and all of the people who don't pay at a score of 300. And because we operate in a world of variability and noise and statistics, models don't rank order perfectly. So the issue then becomes, in a world that is post-recessionary, in an environment of post-recessionary, you want to be using the most up-to-date information to rank order those consumers so that you try to rank order them as perfectly as possible. Models that were built using credit behaviors, consumer behaviors, banking products that were relevant to, let's say, early 2000s, aren't going to rank order as effectively. They're not going to do such a good job. They're just simply not as sensitive to what the consumer is thinking about in terms of this post-recessionary window. Now, an example would be, we've all come through, you know, a very painful time in home ownership. Hopefully we're on the upside of all of that. But still, there's a reticence to look at taking on large mortgages, high interest rates, long loans. That wasn't there 10 plus years ago. So you end up seeing slightly different behaviors. The fact that an older model doesn't capture those new behaviors, those new perspectives on mortgages, means that the model won't be quite as accurate in the way it rank orders consumers. Consequently, we believe that in order to get the best performance for the industry, you need to be using models that are built on relevant timeframes, and that would be, you know, data that's post-recessionary at this point.
So are you capturing different data than the more traditional credit scoring models capture?
The VantageScore model sits on the Credit Bureau credit file data. So we're using all of the data that traditional credit score models use. Where we will perhaps differ is that if there is data associated with telco and utility information, and if that information is sitting in the Credit Bureau files, we will also incorporate that. We've seen both VantageScore 3.0 and FICO 9 already both incorporating rent data. VantageScore 3.0 continues to use telecom data and utility data, and no other models use that. So generally very similar data sets as other scoring models, but if there's incremental information out there in the credit file, we'll incorporate that as well.
So what are some of the outcomes of using different data? It's certainly available for everyone to use. Many aren't. You are. What is the difference in terms of outcome?
Well, so let's say one of the more obvious ones is that there are a small population of U.S. consumers who don't have traditional data on their credit file. They don't have credit cards or vehicle loans or home loans, mortgages, etc. They may be paying rent on an apartment. They may have a cell phone bill. They may be paying their utility bill. If that information is all that they have associated with how they're paying their debts, and that information is reported to the credit bureaus, then VantageScore is going to pick that up and provide that consumer a credit score. Under any other credit score, the consumer would not get a score. If you don't have a score, you're going to find it very hard to get access to mainstream lending and potentially put yourself in a place of exposure for predatory lending, payday type lending, because conventional banking systems don't have statement of risk on you, which is what the credit score is. So that's one of the most obvious results of using this incremental data, is you actually can get a score in some situations. The other thing I would say is that this information, when it's added on to conventional information or traditional credit file information, expands and gives you a better picture of the consumer. So, you know, if you're using that information, you have a more comprehensive understanding of their debt picture and a more comprehensive understanding of how they're repaying those debts. And for example, if a consumer has telco trade or utility trade on their credit file and they're paying those bills on time, then they should get credit for that. And their score would improve as a result of that. So that's another sort of immediate benefit of using these data when it's available.
So are you seeing interest on the part of particular types of lenders for using this model? We'll talk in a minute about what's involved if these lenders want to make your model part of what they're using to extend lending decisions. But where's the interest coming from?
The interest is coming across the board, actually. You know, we've obviously, again, come back out of a period of when we were pretty shut down in terms of giving access to credit. And every bank that I've talked with in the last several years is now, you know, saying, how do we open up credit again? How do we give access to credit? So, you know, what VantageScore 3 is able to do is scores the traditional conventional populations in the United States, but it will also score 30 to 35 million more consumers. And so given every bank is looking for ways to get a good risk assessment on a larger population because they're ready to open up their business, they're very interested in VantageScore. Consequently, we're having conversations across the board.
So what is involved in actually having a lender who's using the traditional credit scoring models adopt VantageScore 3.0? Is that a painful process? What has to happen?
You know, the reality is that it's actually not a painful process. It seems like a painful process because in many ways, the generic scores that have been used are sort of deeply embedded in banks' strategies. But what a lender has to realize, and most of them obviously do, is that the score is simply a proxy for a statement of risk. So it's a statement of risk. And what you also have to recognize is when you're looking at implementing a new credit score, whether it's going from, you know, one brand to another brand, so a credit bureau score to a VantageScore, or you're staying within brands, so VantageScore 2 to VantageScore 3, you want to also understand how the consumers that you work with are scored under the new score. So in other words, what is the distribution of your consumers into each score band? How many consumers get a score between 600 and 620, between 621 and 640? You want to know that population distribution when you're thinking about a new score. You also want to know what your default rate distribution is. So within each one of those score bands, how many people actually defaulted? Having those two pieces of information as they apply to your strategy is all that is necessary. And I think this is where we want to pull back the sense of confusion and the sense of complexity. In reality, the only thing you have to understand is for your strategy, whatever your score cutoff is, if you have I'm only going to originate loans with consumers with scores over 700. Well, that 700 actually is indicative of a particular level of risk that your business can tolerate. And you have an assumption that you will approve a certain number of consumers. When you're thinking about a new score, you want to just understand, if I move to a 700 under this new model, am I going to have the same level of risk or a better level of risk or a worse level of risk? You want to understand what the risk is, and you want to understand how many people, the volume of consumers you're going to approve. And ideally, you're going to move to a new model. You're going to have a lower level of risk at that particular score cutoff for your strategy, and you will have more people scoring, more people approved as a result of that strategy with the new model. And that's the essence of the, let's call it, the process for converting from one model to another. You're simply trying to relate the score to the default rate and the population volume. And that same question, again and again, repeated for every single strategy you have within the bank, it ends up being pretty frequently repeated exercise as you work through implementation, and actually at the end of the day, a relatively simple one.
So are you finding that the financial institutions that have implemented VantageScore, have they actually seen the outcome that you've described? So have they been able to increase the throughput of borrowers without assuming more risk and affecting their default rates?
Yes, we've certainly, I've heard some anecdotal information. Obviously, lender strategies are, highly confidential. It's their sort of their way of beating competition. But what we certainly understand is that for some of their strategies, they're able to have the same level of throughput, originate the same volume of consumers at a lower level of risk. So they're still able to bring on all of those people, but have lower losses associated with them. So that's a win for them. Mm-hmm. Or they're able to keep the same level of risk and actually originate more consumers, have a larger throughput. And certainly we're seeing and hearing that of those examples in both cases.
So one of the things that you mention in your new white paper is something about the plug-and-play method. What is that?
Plug-and-play is intended to really get at the fact that, or challenge this notion that implementing a new credit score is highly complex and fraught with, challenge. When, for any number of strategies within your bank, when you have, and you're looking at implementing a new model, if you have a very similar population distribution between the two models, the old model that's in place right now and the model that you want to work to, if the population distribution is pretty similar and you're able to get a marginal improvement in default rates at your score cutoff, in other words, a lower default rate, then you're really not changing the quality of the strategy in any significant way. In those situations, you really actually can just sort of plug in the new score and play straight away. You don't have major complexity, you've not got a lot of risk exposure as a result of it. So the idea behind plug and play was very similar population distributions, a similar default rate profile, perhaps a little better at your score cutoff. You can just plug and play the new model and get up and running straight away.
Interesting. Well, it's been a really interesting conversation about not only the need for considering a new way of scoring consumers in the new world that we find ourselves living in, but a way for lenders to find tens of millions of new candidates for their lending products. Thanks for joining me today, Sarah.
Thanks very much.